Good evening, everyone. I'm Linor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. Well, get this. Each year, 2.9 million newborns needlessly die within the first month, and an additional 2.6 million are stillborn. The main causes are complications due to prematurity, complications during delivery, and infection. These causes are often preventable and treatable, and medical experts say maternal health is closely linked to newborn survival. Every day, about 800 women die from preventable causes related to pregnancy and childbirth. The World Health Organization says almost all of these deaths occur in low-income settings as a result of conditions that include severe bleeding, infection, high blood pressure, and complications during delivery. On the program today, we will discuss maternal and children's health and look at how some governments are tackling the issue. It is my great pleasure today to have in the studio an extraordinary panel of experts. Our guests are Dr. Isaac Adewole. He is the Nigerian Minister of Health. And Dr. Adewole, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you and good evening.
And we also have Dr. Patrick Abrache. He is Ghana's Ministry of Health Director of the Family Health Division. Dr. Abrache, thank you so much.
Thank you and good evening.
We also have Dr. Darez Ahmed. He is India Ministry of Health Mission Director of the National Health Service in Tamil Nadu. Dr. Ahmed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you and good evening.
And last but not least, Dr. Alan Damiba, he's Senior Vice President, Technical Leadership and Global Programs with JPIGO. Dr. Damiba, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
All right, as I said, this panel of experts is very interesting, different perspective, but all about maternal and children's health. Let me start with you, Professor Isaac Adewole. You are the Minister of Health, and you know people talk a lot about the maternal and children's health situation in Nigeria. The United Nations says every single day Nigeria loses about 2,300 under 5 years old and 145 women of childbearing age die. Now, this makes the country one of the largest contributors to the under five and maternal mortality rate in the world, according to the UN. How does this make you feel when you hear this as the Minister of Health?
Thank you. It energizes me into doing something radical, something extraordinary, and something unique, because my job as the Minister is to turn the tide around, and we are quite committed to doing this. I've been largely supported by my president and the cabinet into making sure that Nigerian is removed from this League of Shame Nations.
Yes. All right. That's great. Now, Dr. Abache, let me come to you. 955 maternal deaths were recorded nationwide in the year 2016. That's according to you. It's something I found on the internet that you said. So please comment on this statistic. What do you make of it?
Well, I think, thanks for having me. That is quite a significant number. And if you look at the absolute numbers, and it is something that we are also looking at greatly. We've been doing some mapping to see where are the greatest challenges so that we can tackle them. What we have noticed is that there are clusters where you have high maternal deaths, and so it's quite easy to tackle those areas to see how we can look at them. Last year, we did a lot in two regions where we found significant numbers to see how we can improve, find the causes, and also quickly intervene and address them.
Great, and we'll hear more about this. Now, from Ghana, we go to India, and that brings me to you, Dr. Darez Ahmed. India bears the largest amount of maternal death for any single country in the world. However, Tamil Nadu is one of the best performers in the country in terms of maternal mortality. So tell us about that. How are you able to kind of lift yourself out of the big picture and make such great strides?
Thank you. And as far as the national perspective is concerned, a lot of great schemes are being implemented. We have the Prime Minister's Maternity Benefit Scheme. We have the Prime Minister's Safe Motherhood Program. Now, and we have the Safe Labor Room program. So a lot of schemes have been being put in place to have that for the national perspective. But from my limited perspective of the state, which where I can comment, I would like to say that we have a maternal mortality rate of 62, and we have a maternity benefit scheme which we have been running, which is a conditional cash transfer scheme for different stages of the motherhood, from early registration to delivery, immunization, and a selection of contraception. So this has helped us in we have been able to deliver this result. And moreover, the state has a maternal and child tracking system, whereby we track all the mothers and we are able to find out how the pregnancy progresses and how the outcomes are and what any high risk incidents are there. The tracking system and the maternity benefit scheme, the conditional cash transfer, has been our cornerstone of our maternal health program.
Fantastic, and we'll find out more about it. Now, Dr. Dameba, let me come to you. When you look at the big pictures, when we hear this statistic, and it seems like a lot of the bad news, quote unquote, is in the developing world and low-income countries. They bear the burden of the maternal death and child death. What do you make of it, and how do we bring Africa out of this dark statistic for brighter days?
I think. One important thing that we are starting to see in many countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, is the political will that is now transforming into political action. We are seeing that more resources are being allocated to maternal health, family planning. We see that policies that are favoring decentralization, task sharing between health workers, between physicians and nurses and midwives, services that are being moved closer to where people live. We are seeing some progress, and we are very optimistic that over the next few years we will make more progress than we did under the MDGs.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Now, Professor Adewale, you said that your role, one of your roles is exactly to ensure that this bad negative statistic and no longer are said about Nigeria. So tell us about some of the steps that the government are making to improve maternal health and child health.
Well, we have undertaken quite a number of actions. The first is to continue the policy of free contraceptive commodity supply in the country. We have even upped the provision. Initially, it hovered around $1 to $3 million US dollars per year. In 2017, we have $3 million US dollars. In 2018, we are proposing $4 million into the basket fund. That will ensure that every Nigerian. In addition to that, we've launched a new policy on delivery in order to increase contraceptive prevalence across the country. Not only that, we are revitalizing the nation's health system, making primary care the focal point. This will enable us to reach people even in the remotest part of the country. When you look at the data from Nigeria, it's so easy to talk about the 576 per 100,000 women. But beyond that figure, you recognize that there is a disconnect, a huge gap between the rich and the poor, between the educated and the non-educated, between the rich and the poor. So the educated, the urban, and the rich have health indicators quite similar to what you have in Europe and the United States. So our job is to continue to do things that will take many Nigerians out of poverty, improve education, improve health-seeking behavior. We are also looking at many policies to improve survival of newborn. And one of the things we are using is to really implement the cloxidine policy, where we will apply cloxidine gel to the umbilical cord and eliminate children who will die from tetanus and other infections. So there are many things we're doing.
And Dr. Abuakche, to what extent is poverty influential in maternal health and childhood survival?
Yeah, thank you. Poverty is one of the greatest drivers for maternal mortality, because maternal mortality is a developmental issue. It goes beyond health. Your health-seeking behavior plays a role. Where you live, how you understand your own body, how you appreciate risks are up. And so poverty, and especially educating the girl child education, education of women, it's extremely important in actually reducing maternal mortality. And so we are actually pushing that so much in terms of trying to reduce child marriage, making sure that more girls get to school. We have a program of re-entry where even girls who get pregnant after delivery are reintegrated back to school, just so that they can stay in school. And that is a way of driving out of poverty and making sure that they also have the economic power to be part of the decision making in the home and also be able to take care of themselves. So it's an important part, and girl child marriage, etc., are all areas that are not helping. We have a special ministry of gender that tries to push and ensure that women are empowered, and not just in terms of the voice, but also economically, so that we can reduce poverty and reduce maternal mortality. We believe that's an important driver, and that we must tackle that.
And Dr. Ahmed, Dr. Abache talked about women's empowerment. Was that one factor that helped your region to improve in maternal health? How are you empowering women?
See, if you look at our gender empowerment index, the women work participation, we have a very high rate of women work participation, and women are actively involved in our self-help group movement, in all the economic activities. So that gives a lot of freedom for the women for make decisions. And we have a fertility rate of 1.6. So that's almost a replacement level of fertility. So the age of marriage has been steadily climbing, age at marriage. So child marriages are rare and rare now compared to earlier. So there's a lot of gender-related improvements which is happening, and that is contributing, and female literacy rate and the enrollment. If you look at our gross enrollment ratio in colleges, and female-male participation is almost the same at higher education. So that has really helped us in achieving all these targets, and gender empowerment has always been a part, not specific, as a part of all these achievements for us.
That's great. Now, Dr. Damiba, when we talk about gender empowerment, very often we think about women, right? But I'm one to believe that men should be part of the discussion, because if you empower women, you tell them, you take them to school, they graduate, they become Minister of Health, and then she's married to a man who starts feeling insecure. He will still abuse her, for example. I'm just giving you an example. So how do we bring men in the picture to ensure that as women are being empowered, men are not left behind, and they understand the importance of an empowered woman and supporting that woman?
Yeah. This is a really important topic. We are seeing that many countries now, and this is true, many countries now are looking at women who are pregnant shouldn't be dying because they are giving birth. And many of the things that are happening to women through pregnancy, it's because society, men, haven't made a decision that women shouldn't die giving birth. That's one. The second thing is when a woman is in labor in a village, and there has to be a decision to seek care when there is a complication. That decision to go and seek care in a facility is usually in the hand of the husband or the in-laws.
Yeah.
And so there is a control by men. And we have to work, many countries are working with community leaders to figure out how to empower women to seek help, because she's not supposed to complain, she's not supposed to say it's painful, she's not supposed to talk about complication. So working with men around decision to seek care early is very important. The third thing is, once the woman reach a facility, it's very important to work with men so that they are companion, what we call a respectful maternity care. Men are part of the process. A woman can bring a companion. She can deliver in any position she wants. She can have the help she needs. So those are some of the things that we see countries doing, which I think will help involve men more.
Okay, and I would like to have your reaction on the men's, just that question about the role of men, because again, when it comes to women's health, men in many cultures have a say. So, Minister Adewale.
Well, I cannot but agree with Alan for his contribution, that gender does not really imply a female focus. Gender looks at the dynamics between male and female, and the way we integrate both for the development of the society. So when we do not carry men along, in many of our societies, women tend to suffer. And so what we need to do is we need to get men involved. Men should be encouraged to empower their wives, allow them to take on jobs. Men should free their wives to be examined by male doctors. There are many things. Men should be encouraged to allow their wives and their daughters to go to school. So when we had this together, we would definitely tilt the balance. Because, and then we raise the bar by saying that these women ought not to die because they want to give back to us.
Great. And Dr. Aboce, your
turn. Yeah, I think I agree perfectly with the minister's position on that. But I think men must be educated to be able to carry out this and understand the issues of pregnancy and its effects. I think I've seen a situation where in Japan where the man is put a bag to feel pregnant and see how he really feels. I think men must be educated, must be, go through a process to see what the woman really goes through in pregnancy. Then we'll begin to see the changes that we expect them to appreciate. Yeah.
Interesting experiment to have a man feel what it's like to be pregnant.
Give you some 9 kilo weight to carry and around the belly and see how it feels.
You know, someone once said that if only men could get pregnant, even for one day, men's attitude to issues like family planning, to supporting their women, will change.
I agree, I think. Dr. Ahmed, do you have a comment?
Regarding if you look at contraception, and there is a, in general terms, there is a disproportionate burden on females for contraception, and men should share that burden to a greater extent, so that it is not a person, like if we plan the family, it is not the only the responsibility of the female, it should be the woman, it should be the men also. When they talk about gender comes in, this is one thing, contraception is one thing, which feel that men should actively have a role in permanent, any methods of the contraception.
Fantastic.
The other thing I want to add is the financing. It's very important. Even if a woman decides to go and seek care in a facility, you have to pay. And so therefore, in many countries, you have to pay. So if you don't control the finance and it's the husband, you can make any decision you want. You won't be able to go and seek care because you won't be able to pay. So we have to figure out ways for women to be economically empowered too.
Absolutely. Mm. That's such a good point, economic empowerment. And it's time to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue this fantastic discussion with our great special guest today. Don't go away. It is, you're listening to Health Chat, and it's now time for the news with Imutinyan Abueje.
The World Health Organization is calling for resolute action to end violence against children. WHO comes in advance of a meeting in Stockholm, Sweden this week. The meeting aims to seek solution to the problem of violence, which affects one out of every two children on this planet. The upcoming conference will explore ways to achieve the UN's Sustainable Development Goal of ending violence against children by 2030. The World Health Organization reports one half of 2 billion children on Earth age between 2 and 17 are victims of physical, sexual, or emotional violence or neglect. This violence is says occur in the home, behind closed doors, or in schools. It involves bullying and violent behavior between young people. The WHO says violence thrives in situations of conflict and other fragile settings. In another report, the World Health Organization says progress in fighting malaria is at risk. The newly released WHO annual report looks at global fights against the disease. It says that malaria cases are on the rise in several African countries. Many countries are moving towards eliminating malaria, among them Madagascar, Senegal, and Zimbabwe. However, the WHO report warns in others, progress is stagnant. Malaria cases increased by more than 20% from 2015 to 2016 in 8 African countries, including Rwanda, Nigeria, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The WHO is calling for improving coverage of existing methods of malaria prevention, as well as urgent investment in new tools, namely a malaria vaccine. Speaking of malaria, Tests in West Africa have found that a safe drug long used to treat urinary tract infection is also effective against malaria. But the medication has one disadvantage. It turns urine a vivid blue. Medline blue, a dye used to stain tissues viewed under a microscope, can be taken by tablet or injection and is sometimes used to treat urethral infections and a hemoglobin disorder. But the dye also kills the malaria parasite in the gametocyte stage, the point at which mosquitoes pick up from human blood and pass it on to new victims. Modern malaria treatments based on the drugs artemisinin are still effective in Africa and save hundreds of thousands of lives each year. But scientists fear that the parasite will develop resistance, as they have in Southeast Asia, and seeking ways to kill them faster using cocktail of several drugs. And that is a wrap-up of your latest health news. Lenore, back to you.
Thank you, Imuti Nyan, and welcome back. For those of you joining us late tonight, we are discussing maternal and newborn health, and we are looking at what is being done by governments in different countries. My guests are Dr. Isaac Adewole, he's the Nigerian Minister of Health. We also have Dr. Patrick Abuakye, Ghana's Ministry of Health Director of the Family Health Division, Dr. Dares Ahmed, India Ministry of Health Mission Director of the National Health Service in Tamil Nadu, and Dr. Alan Damiba, he's Senior Vice President of Technical Leadership and Global Programs with J. Paigo. Now, we are looking at what governments are doing. However, I wanted us to talk about the private sector, because without the robust private sector, health cannot all fall on the government, right? So how is your government encouraging, supporting, and facilitating a robust private sector healthcare? Let me start with you, Mr. Minister.
Thank you so much. We recognize very early that private sector participation is crucial. The private sector has quite a number of advantages that we can tap into: the efficiency, the discipline, and the resources available in the private sector. But we must also factor in the challenges of issue of quality, and how do we get data from the private sector, and also how do we eliminate abuse in the private sector. For now, they are quite involved in the dispensation of family planning services across the country. That is good for us. We are also getting them involved in primary care services. There are quite a number of the private sector organizations that we're working with. And one of them, which is like our flagship project, actually put in place a private health facility and donated it to the community. And it's being jointly managed by his foundation and the community. And we are using that as a model. And you now have a partnership between the foundation, the community, and the teaching hospital. And they jointly manage this facility. And at the last count, they registered over 1,000 people in the facility. And interestingly, they also have money in their account, which to me implied that even such facilities, even in the urban setting, can make profit. Although in the rural area, we will not expect them to be able to sustain themselves. So working with the private sector, to me, is good for us. But then we need to define the rules of engagement.
Exactly. And Dr. Ahmed, I wanted to get from you how you are working with the private sector.
See, as regards to maternity and child health schemes are running is concerned, government primarily is focusing on government sector to deliver the MCH services. 70% of our deliveries happens in government sector, 30% in private sector. Basically, but for engagement in private sector, the state believes in a strategic purchasing. Wherever there is a gap in specific areas, then that is covered through an insurance model. And we cover almost 1,000 procedures under an insurance scheme. And there is an engagement with the private sector to that extent, wherever there is a gap in that's a strategic decision. And always the state believes in strengthening government system, a strong government system coexisting with a private good government private sector, so that the problems of moral hazard when you start purchasing from private sectors are equally tackled by a checks and balances of a strong government system existing.
Okay, and Dr. Abuakye, in Ghana, what type of collaboration do you have with the private sector?
Yeah, I think we have the private for profit and private not for profit. But for now, I think I talk more about the private for profit. We creating the enabling environment for them, especially to participate in maternal and child health. And over the years, since the introduction of the health insurance, the private sector has been expanding and also improving coverage. So that's how we do the insurance services, and the government creates. What we do is the government to provide the regulation, ensure standards are maintained, and that women are, and patients are protected. And I think that's what the government system is. But the platform has been created that allows them, and they are actually growing. And I think it means that it's helping.
Okay, and Dr. Damibag, with JPIGO, what type of approach do you have to ensure that the private sector and government collaborate in doing your work?
Yeah, we at JPIGO, we always tell the government when we visit countries and we are in a partnership with ministries of health that JPIGO is only in the country to support the Ministry of Health strategy.
Okay.
We are following, working with the government, sitting in technical working groups, looking at the evidence with them, and together we are deciding what the best way forward is based on the evidence. So we usually support the government efforts. Usually we will recommend that the government, in order to increase access, you really cannot only rely on the public sector. You have to bring in private sector actors, because that's a good way to increase access to services. More than 50% of services provided in sub-Saharan Africa are from private sector, actually, which are sometimes the first place that people go to for services. And when they have a complication, then they get evacuated into the public sector tertiary hospital. So we are making a point to work with the governments, the ministries of health, to push and make sure that the private sector is at the table.
Okay. Now, there is a question that I wanted to ask. The issue of brain drain. I mean, we have so many brilliant experts that perhaps travel to get some training and don't remain in these countries outside
like
of
you?
The original.
Like you?
Yes. How do you encourage me to return to my country? That's a good one. Yeah. So what do we do about brain drain? Just different ideas. It doesn't have to be very complicated, but how do we encourage the medical experts to return to the countries?
Well, my first submission is that brain drain is an international phenomenon.
Yes.
It must happen. It is the level that we need to control. When people move from one country to the other, there are benefits. I'm presently working on a program that will involve Nigerians professionals in diaspora, particularly doctors, nurses, and pharmacists. We call it the 111 scheme, where we're encouraging them to spend 11 months here and come and spend 1 month in Nigeria. And when they spend 1 month in Nigeria, they will be able to support us. They will then realize that home is not too bad, things are not too unbearable, and we might be able to tap one or two back out of maybe a dozen that are out there. But for now, let us gain from them.
All right. And for you, before we close, I just wanted you to comment on the Millennium Development Goal 5 in reducing maternal mortality, child mortality, and improving maternal health, the MDG 5. How do you see Ghana, very quickly?
Well, as far as the MDGs are concerned, I think we just finished with the MDGs and we had done
the SDGs.
Yes, Sustainable Development Goals. We are working towards, we are supposed to get to our maternal mortality rate of about 70, because we belong to the group of countries that has to. What we think we need to do is to continue advocacy to achieve both the child targets for maternal mortality and child mortality. Increase advocacy, ensure that the non-health actors are brought to the table, to ensure that the infrastructure change, all the social cultural practices are also addressed. We have to improve quality of care.
Yes,
important.
Okay,
to be able to improve more technology.
We have to leave it there. One final word, Dr. Mohammed, very quickly. One final word.
And the path towards SDGs are laid with many challenges, and as a state and the country, we are putting in all our efforts to reach the SDG goals the world has put up before us.
Great. Dr. Damiba, thank you so much. We're out of time. Thank you for coming. Dr. Adewole, Dr. Abuakche, Dr. Ahmed, it was such a pleasure to have all of you.
Thank you.
I'm your host, Linor Mudu, in Washington, with producer Jackson Vunganyi. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after.